This is Ron Oral, and I'm super excited today to be speaking with Carmen Liu, who recently joined Paul Weiss in New York as a partner focused on activism defense. Carmen arrived on January 13th from Wachtell Lipton, another powerhouse law firm, where she began her career. And she advises companies and their boards on shareholder activism, corporate governance, and ESG matters, as well as stakeholder engagement and evolving market and regulatory trends and practices. Among her engagement, Liu advised Twilio on a settlement that added a partner at activist fund Sachem Head as a director. And she also advised healthcare REIT Ventas in a campaign by real estate activist Land and Building Investment Management. And she counseled Pinterest and Salesforce on ESG and activism defense matters. So some pretty big situations. Thank you, Carmen, for taking the time.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me, Ron.
Okay, so let's talk about the kinds of things you'll be working on at Paul Weiss. Curious if most of your work will be focusing on kind of live activist situations, or are you going to be spending a lot of your time on kind of these clear, what we call clear day advice to companies on how to avoid an activist investor?
You know, it's going to be a combination of both. I would say a significant proportion of my time and work will be focused on preparing companies for activism. You often hear, you know, the best defense against activism is strong performance. I would add that the next best defense is making sure management and the board is ready when the activist calls. And I would also add, I think advanced preparation has become an even more important component of effective activism defense strategy, because activists are calling more often than ever before, including at companies that are performing well. And our philosophy is every campaign comes down to winning the hearts and minds of investors. So the focus of any advanced preparation is about taking all the appropriate steps necessary to keep investors on side.
Okay, so that'll be interesting to see how you're going to split your time. I suspect there'll be more than a couple of live activist situations to work on as well. So, you know, at The Deal, we're always fascinated with that subset of activism that involves M&A activism. And, you know, we've seen a lot of succession demands in 2024. And I think overall M&A activism was kind of down a bit, particularly in the couple months leading up to the election where people were very kind of uncertain about what kind of deals might get through. I think maybe they're still uncertain about what kind of deals might get through, but I suspect we might see, already anecdotally in my reporting at The Deal, seeing an increased uptick in demands for divestitures, demands to sell the company, activists urging companies to accept unsolicited bids. Just seems like a lot of M&A activism in the month of January and first little bit of February of 2025. So how would you expect to see it breaking down? Will we see a succession demand? Are we going to see a lot of M&A demands? And I guess overall, how are you seeing the M&A market?
I think you're hitting on all the right trends. You know, on M&A, we actually had probably a slower start to January than expected because of the uncertainty around tariffs and the interest rate environment. I think that said, there remains a significant amount of optimism and I think a lot of pent-up M&A ambition from the last few years. And I think the expectation is that M&A is going to pick up in the coming weeks and it's going to be a phenomenal year for M&A in 25. That's obviously going to impact activism in a number of ways. I think first, we can probably expect to see an uptick in campaigns that involve M&A theses, as opposed to the operational and strategic thesis that we commonly saw last year. I think second, we might start to see kind of a return of private equity and activists all competing in the same pool, which is, you know, seeing PE funds adopt activist tactics and then activists starting to behave more like PE funds and, you know, opportunities where they can take companies and targets private. I think the third trend we're going to continue seeing, and this is kind of a flow on from last year, is, you know, the continued pressure for portfolio simplification. And a lot of that is going to be driven by these accelerating secular trends, particularly in AI automation, which is really pushing all companies to start revising and sharpening their strategy. And that's creating also quite a bit of dislocation in the trajectory of different business units. So that kind of creates an opportunity for activists to push for a breakup. I think when we look at kind of CEO succession, we did see last year a significant number of departures brought on by activists. I think the pressure and scrutiny on CEOs is going to remain in 2025. And I think the reason for that is because the job has become more complicated and more unpredictable. So today, CEOs, they have to juggle issues like geopolitics, domestic political turbulence, alongside all the different structural changes that are happening in the economy. And so when you have so much on your plate, it's much easier to make mistakes. And I think we've also seen this interesting trend last year where boards are also becoming more proactive and perhaps a bit less forgiving of missteps.
A couple of things I just wanted to like narrow in on a little bit. That was fascinating, your point about the P funds adopting activist tactics. I've seen numerous P funds launch unsolicited bids, some P funds doing kind of activist approaches and strategies, whether it's with accumulating large derivatives positions and then seeking to become the kind of white square defense at companies facing other activists, but embracing kind of activist strategies. But I'll be interested to see if we'll see more activists adopting P strategy. We always, you know, there's a few big ones that are able to acquire companies, but I'm interested to see whether you see activists, you know, try to buy companies in the future. And a lot of that is taking place in the technology, media, and telecom sector. And I know that historically, Carmen, you've done a lot of work in this area. And I have the Barclays report from 2024, their activist report. And in it, technology was the second most targeted sector for activists for the year. So I guess with that comment, do you expect to see the sector will face as much activism in 2025 as in 2024? Maybe more, maybe less? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think 2025 could still be a pretty busy year for tech companies of all sizes. And I think the reason for this is twofold. I think first, when you look at the largest companies, they've seen significant stock appreciation over the past year, and they have done very well, but they're not impervious to activism because the sector itself is undergoing significant and rapid change. And a lot of that is being brought on by AI and automation, and it's applying a lot of pressure on companies to rapidly pivot and adapt their business and strategy. And in the process of all of this, it's going to be dislocation. And so I think as companies start to make changes, and many of them will rush to make changes, there will be mistakes or shorter mistakes. There may be pivots that may not seem fast enough for investors. And I think in those cases, there are going to be opportunities for activists. In addition, I think, you know, with the rebound of M&A and all the capital that's being poured into AI, there's going to be a lot of pressure, I think, for larger companies to think about whether or not there are strategic opportunities to make acquisitions. And then I think for smaller companies, you know, there may be opportunities where activists see them as being potential targets or being put up to sale.
You know, it's interesting. I always have this feeling that the technology sector shouldn't be so targeted by activists simply because we've seen a trend in recent years of lots of tech companies doing their IPOs with these dual class share structures, giving insiders, founders control the vote. I guess the classic example of that is Facebook IPOing with Mark Zuckerberg controlling a majority of the vote, even though he has a small percentage of the overall shares. Now, of course, Meta. But a lot of those dual class structures, I notice, are sunsetting. And that's something that at the deal, we kind of keep an eye on when those sunsets take place. And as we see them approaching, we kind of take a closer look at those companies because we often see activists show up shortly before or after the sunsets take place. But then there's a lot of other companies that where there is no sunset and or there is none on the immediate horizon, and they still have activists show up. And activists I've seen have succeeded at getting settlements, at getting directors on the board of insider-controlled companies. And then there was this very interesting situation with Starboard Value, did this non-binding proposal at News Corp, which is as a dual class structure with Rupert Murdoch, his affiliates, family controlling the majority of the vote. So I guess that's a long way of saying, what do you think about these dual class structures and whether they're an impediment for activism or not?
Yeah, Ron, I think to your point, a dual class structure can be protective against activism in the sense that, you know, particularly in the early days following an IPO, the high vote block is often sufficient to shield the board in a proxy contest. Now, that being said, I think one should never assume that just merely having a dual class structure is a bulletproof defense against activism. And there are several reasons for that. I think the first thing to bear in mind is that activists do, and as you've talked about, have successfully targeted dual class companies. And that's because activists have a whole range of objectives, and some of which does not necessarily mean that they need to get the support of the majority of the shareholder base. I think the second reason is, you know, you've got a lot of companies where the high vote shares are held by more than one person. And so in those instances, it actually becomes an opportunity for the activist to figure out how can I neutralize the high vote shares by driving a wedge and pitting the high vote holders against each other, essentially neutralizing the impact of the high vote shares entirely in certain circumstances. And then I think third, another reason why I think activists succeed sometimes at dual class companies is because they're able to divide the board of management or create a huge amount of internal fatigue And that happens because, you know, when you are dealing with an activist as a company, you have two jobs to do. You've got to run the business and do a better job of running the business. And you've also have to deal with the activist. And when this drags on over time, it creates, you know, a lot of opportunities for not just fatigue, but divisions internally. And then I think fourth, I think, you know, going to your point about, you know, you observe activists showing up when a company's dual class sunsets, you know, whether or not the sunsetting of the dual class increases activism risk, I think is really ultimately dependent on the company. Because for a well-run company, the activism risk shouldn't meaningfully increase because their dual class structure has sunset, because an activist still has to show up with a good thesis. But I think in reality, often what you see is when the sunset is occurring, it's also a period of transition in leadership, a transition in business strategy. The company's going through these growing pains, and that creates opportunities for activism.
Yeah, a lot of the ones that we see where the sunset is collapsing have boards that have raised red flags for me and our other reporters at the deal. And so I guess as they approach that, maybe they need to hire Paul Weiss to advise them on kind of refreshing their board. But, you know, some of them are fine. You're right. They, when they collapse and the company's doing well and they're not necessarily can be a target. And the other point that you made, which I thought was fascinating, which is the activists can kind of pit one of the controlling voters against the other. I'm writing about a fascinating situation of a family control founder of a company where I was looking at the 8K and I noticed after a annual meeting and I noticed a huge block, not all of it, but like, let's say, I don't know, 25% to 30% of the Class B super voting shares voted against one of the directors who's a family member. So it's like, so that, you know, indicated to me and indicated to some of these activist institutional investors that there was a disagreement among the family about the company's future. Anyway, so it's interesting. Yeah. I've seen activists historically, if they can identify some subset of the super voting shares that maybe would support their thesis, that's a big deal. So anyways, I just thought I would throw those points out there. So.
And Ron, to your point about board refreshment, I think it's a really important point you raised, because I think board refreshment is uniquely interesting at companies that have dual class structures, because at many of these companies, they're kind of shifting. They're shifting from being very extremely successful startups that IPO'd to large institutions. And I think in the process of all this happening, directors, those skill sets that made perfect sense at the IPO date may no longer be fit for purpose and be prime targets for potential board refreshment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I will continue to look at dual class share companies. We have this list of companies we think could be targeted by an activist and kind of do an analysis of those. And a lot of times we've kind of ignored the dual class, but we will continue to look at some dual class companies where we see a lot of red flags to add on our list of companies that could be targeted by an activist. Okay. So another situation I thought was fascinating that we saw a lot of last year, and I suspect we'll see more of in 2025, is situations where multiple activists materialize at a particular company. So, Carmen, if you're advising a company, how would you manage that? And relatedly, I feel like sometimes if you have one activist there, you have multiple activists there, you might want to bring another one in as what some people in the industry like to call white squire investment. Get the other activist to buy stake, get on the board, and that will discourage the first activist from pursuing their campaign. I guess that's the ideal situation. But overall, though, white squires can be private equity firms buying large minority stakes to help get on the board to also help fend off the activist, or it could be all kinds of investors. But basically, it's in a situation maybe where you see one or two activists agitating and you maybe you bring one in. So I guess there's two questions in here. One is, what do you do when you have multiple activists materialize? And second, this white squire strategy, does it make sense to do that, to bring private equity to buy a large minority stake, or bring in one of the activists in and to get on the board to help fend off the other activists?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, Ron, you're right. I mean, we are seeing increasingly multiple activists show up at the same company. And that's not really surprising if you think about how it works in activism. Activists are talking to the same groups of investors and analysts, and many activists are also sector specialists. So at any given time, there's going to be a handful of targets that everyone is going to be interested in. So when a company does get approached by multiple activists, I think it's very important for them to understand that not all activists are the same. You're going to have these activists who have a long record, strong credibility with the market, a very well-developed thesis. And then you're going to have activists who are newer and looking to get attention and gain credibility. So how you manage multiple activists, it starts with understanding what each activist brings to the table and calibrating your response accordingly. And I think one thing to also bear in mind is that what activists all want, for the most part, at the end of the day, is to score a healthy financial return. And that's something to keep in mind when you're parsing through all the different ideas all these multiple activists are going to be throwing at the company. As to white squires, I think it really all depends on the situation at hand. And I think it's not always a free lunch for the company. The board should certainly be well advised as to its fiduciary responsibilities in those situations. I would say, you know, there certainly does appear to be some renewed interest from private equity firms to deploy capital in these situations to invest in companies that otherwise wouldn't be a buyout target.
So that's basically this point that I was making, with like private equity could buy a large minority stake and get some directors on the board in a situation where, let's say, an activist hedge fund is agitating from the outside.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, well, they'll be interested to see whether we'll see more of those kind of situations in the months and years to come, and whether we're going to see more white squires. I still think some of these private equity white squires are embracing activist targets, like to the point where you're saying that they want to deploy capital and maybe they can't deploy it to acquire companies. They can deploy it to be a large minority investor, and maybe an activist hedge fund on the outside can help private equity get in there. So anyways, I've seen a few of those recently. I feel like we're going to see more of those in 2025 as well. And so it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. You've been listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast with Ron Orrell. And we've been talking to Carmen Liu at Paul Weiss. Thanks, Carmen, for taking the time.
Thank you.